Hello, welcome back to Party Radio. In this episode, I speak to a gentleman called James Greenfield, who is the CEO and founder of an agency that was originally founded in London, but now has offices sort of scattered around the globe, called Koto. And if you've not heard of Koto, you've probably seen some of that work. During their sort of tenure for the last 9 years, they've done some amazing work that spans clients from Call of Duty to Fanta to Discord to Glassdoor and a lot of other people in between. But basically, they do really amazing work. And we discuss numerous things, including James's influences, his early career, advice that he has for sort of new and up-and-coming designers, and sort of what Koto embodies almost. I'll let the actual interview commence. Enjoy. So yeah, I start these all the same for the people that are listening that maybe don't know yourself. Can you give them a bit of a rundown as to who you are and what you do?
Yeah, of course. So I'm James Greenfield. I'm the CEO of a company called Koto. It's an agency that I started 9 years ago, and we're a company that's got five studios globally. And that's one in London where I sit, and then one in Berlin, one in New York, one in Los Angeles, and a new one in Sydney. And essentially what I do day to day is I help our clients navigate the tricky world of brand. I think it's the easiest way of describing it. And so what that means is help them succeed what they need to succeed with in their company, and hopefully deliver value to them. I used to be a graphic designer, but I think I do a little bit more these days.
Do you still design? Do you still get the chance to kind of get amongst it?
No, not really. I get some ideas out now and again, but yeah, the majority of my time is more in the kind of orchestration and the engagement and the general business of running a 100-person company.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. When did you open the Sydney one? Is that super new?
Yeah, in about the last year. So yeah.
Is the time zone? I don't want to add more things onto what I've wrote down in the questions, but is the time zone thing like really difficult to manage, I assume?
Yeah, it's quite tricky. You totally underestimate how far away Australia is from where I sit in the UK. And obviously there's a lot of time zones between us and them. So yeah, it's one of those things that maybe I underestimated at the beginning.
Yeah. So jumping back before everything sort of began for yourself, can you touch on what sort of first got you into art design?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think, you know, I'm 45 years old, and so sometimes the memory plays tricks on you, but there are certain things that I can remember really clearly. So the absolute cliche that I'm sure a lot of people say on similar questions is always liked drawing as a kid and was always encouraged to draw. And you know, in the pre-smartphone world, I remember my mum keeping us busy with a pen and a piece of paper quite a lot. I think off the back of that, I also, not that I knew what it was then now, but I was somebody who was curious, very interested in things. Why are things the way they are? Why is something being made that way? And when I was at school, one of my art teachers, I think, connected with that curiosity and realized that I could be inspired. And so showed me lots of books about really interesting stuff, things that I would never have any access to growing up in a very rural community, and helped me understand that there was this amazing world out there, which in that pre-internet age, I would never have really probably been able to have access to beyond kind of knowing what I was looking for. And then beyond that, there was kind of the cultural touchstones, which were really, really important for me, which were things like record covers, comic books, things that, you know, I'd obviously been designed, and yet again in this world, not knowing what design was, and not knowing where these things were and who that they were done by, I kind of was fascinated by it. I wanted to know who had made this record cover, or who designed the Phase magazine, which was a magazine that was really big for me back in those days, because it showed me this world. So I think it's a combination of all those factors that led me to the world of design.
Jumping forward to sort of your time at university, could you touch on this sort of early time in your career? And is there any things, sort of standout memories that you can think of that really sort of began to shape who you were going to become?
Well, I was quite lucky as a teenager. I was never really great at school. I had potential. I think every report said exactly the same thing, which was if only you tried harder, you could achieve a lot more. And I think that was a combination of many things. I was undiagnosed dyslexic, but I also didn't really subscribe to a lot of the things we were told in a very traditional school and didn't really identify them with them and felt that my time was best spent elsewhere, which probably made me an absolute nightmare to teach. But one thing we had to do was go and get work experience one summer. And so I think I was 15 years old. I had to go and get work experience. And I typically, like I did in my life at that moment in time, hadn't really done much about it. And then my mum suggested that there was a graphic design agency in our small town. And so through some conversation, I managed to wangle 2 weeks there. And I think it's fair to say that that's a complete pivot on my life that moment in time, because I went from this kind of very traditional school where we were learning about very standard traditional things, which I wasn't really firing me and wasn't really creating my passion, through to suddenly being in this graphic design world, which had these Apple Macs, had these amazing programs, and people were designing things. And all of these things that I were interested in suddenly coalesced around this thought, which I had in the first week there, which was, wow, all of this stuff is designed. Someone's sitting down and spending their day designing these things. And so with a kind of love of computers and a love of art, I'd found this kind of middle ground that existed between that. And so I spent 2 weeks there. And one of the best things that happened to me in those 2 weeks was I was pretty passionate about it. I seem to remember I was bugging them all for, how does this work? How does that work? How do you do this? How do you do that? That one of the guys that worked there gave me a copy of all of the software, which in those days was on CD-ROMs, and let me take it home and install it on my computer at home. And that really turbocharged my potential, because what it meant was, from about the age of 15, I knew how to use Illustrator and Photoshop. And back in those days, it was Quark Express. And so by the time that I went to university to study design, having completed a course in between, a BTEC, software wasn't a consideration to me, because I knew it all pretty well end to end. And so what it meant was, it meant within the environment of being at university and studying graphic design, I had the ability to focus on the ideas and the concept and what I was trying to achieve. And I always felt like that was a bit of an unfair advantage, because for a lot of my contemporaries, they were trying to come up with a great idea, work out why it was conceptually sound, work out how it existed within the world where they wanted it to exist. And then they needed to use software to bring it to life. And I didn't have that kind of blocker of software, because, you know, there was some things I couldn't do, but I was pretty far ahead. And so I think what that did was that allowed me to occupy a freer space where I had this ability to be able to spend my time on those other bits, which other people were maybe having to rush through because they were then worried about making this and landing deadlines and assignments and all those important things. And I think if I look back on that now and I think about it now, I think what that's done is, in my further career, is, you know, I'm not in later life being the most software proficient person, but I've always kind of not had to worry about it so much because I had an early start on it. And what that allowed me to do is be really focused on ideas and concepts and how things exist in the world, etc. And so for me, both pre-university, at university and post-university, it kind of taught me a way of approaching design, which I think has put me in a privileged position in a way that I didn't really realize I was doing it at the time. It was an opportunity moment, luck, and, you know, some hard work as a teenager, where it didn't really feel like hard work spending 8 hours in Photoshop every day, but it really, really did teach me a lot about design and how to manipulate ideas and how to bring them to life.
Do you think, had you not done that internship and learned the skills before you got there and had to kind of learn on the job almost at university, do you think you'd be where you are now?
No, not at all. I think it's a very, very important thing for me in that moment in time. I think if I hadn't done that internship, I don't think I would have found graphic design. So I think it's I think it shows the power of what I would describe as kind of open door moments, where doors open and you have to understand that what's opened in front of you and then grab it, and how you deal with it and understand the residual effect of what that's going to do for the next moment in time. So I you can always reflect on different futures and what would have happened. It's a very classic philosophical debate that we all have. But for me, I think taking a very big blocker for a lot of people out the way early on was incredibly beneficial.
So you did a talk in 2015 for It's Nice That, and you mentioned that when you were younger, and you kind of touched on it a bit, you had an ego that wasn't justified. And that sort of resonated with me a bit, because I had a bit of a thing where I was like, I'm the best graphic designer in the world. I'm a cunt, basically. And I've come on from that, and now I realise I've just been a dickhead. But I just sort of, can you touch on that and sort of, were you able to, is that something you still struggle with now? I assume not, but like, how are you able to balance that essentially?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I think, you know, one of the debates that all creatives can have is what is the role of ego? And I think it's an interesting conversation. You know, I think if you look at it through the lens of art and design, maybe the artist can be defined by their ego or should consider their ego. But for designers, I think whether we like it or not, we are typically in the service of others. Now, that depends upon which medium we're using and how we're expressing it and, you know, how successful we are. But ultimately, we are making something for other people. And so therefore, I think my reflection later in life where I stand now was that as a younger designer, and you're picking up from that theme from that talk I did quite a few years ago, but as a younger designer, I was maybe too focused on what I was creating for myself in my kind of want to make these artifacts or these kind of monuments to my own brilliance, rather than really focusing on actually what am I trying to achieve here? What's the goals of this? And I think, you know, a part of that came from a vulnerability. I think, you know, what we go through in life is these series of moments where we go through a period of time. So whether that's school, where we get to the top and we feel like, you know, we're the oldest, we're the most accomplished, then we go to university. And if that's your path and you're back at the bottom, or you go into the world of work and you're back at the bottom, then you have to work up. And I think what I found when I look back on my first few years of my career now is that I was so used to probably being one of the stronger voices in the room in these other environments, or someone that has always been blessed with a certain level of self-confidence, that I maybe failed to truly grasp my role at that moment in time and what I was meant to be doing and my role within a team and how I was meant to be operating and what I should be of kind of aiming for and achieving. And so therefore, I think that kind of, I fought with that ego for a number of years. And I think if I look back on the first 3, 4, 5 years of my career, it took quite a lot of backwards and forwards for me to really begin to kind of actually, for it to click and for me to understand. And there's, you know, you can look back on moments in time, and like I said earlier, think about them and you think, you kind of reflect back on them differently maybe than how they were. But there's a very funny one that stands out for me, which is one of my former bosses who is now a really good friend of mine, was really frustrated with me turning up for work late every day. And it was, you know, very basic. I was staying up too late in the evening playing games or listening to music or doing my own freelance design or whatever. And so therefore I was not getting enough sleep and missing my alarm and therefore being late for work. And he said to me when I think I was about 25, he pulled me into a meeting room and he said, look, if you're really serious about this career, one of the number one basics that you need to be able to achieve is turning up on time every day. And I can remember I walked out of that room and it was like the most ridiculously seismic moment. And for him, he probably just thought he was dealing with another one of his employees being a bit lapsed and generally not being able to connect themselves with the rest of the human race. But for me, I went home that day and I was like, he's completely right. I've been completely letting myself down. I'm never going to be late for work again. This is absolutely unacceptable. And in that moment, I had this insane pivot moment where I just took everything so much more seriously, stopped kind of complaining to myself about things that I felt were unfair, stopped seeing myself as someone that had been unlucky or had missed out on opportunities or all of these things, which I let myself probably through a kind of vulnerability run through my head. And I just thought, you know what, the only way to be successful at this is I just have to apply myself. I have to understand what my weaknesses are. I have to understand what my strengths are. I have to properly engage with team and a team mentality. And I have to really understand that if I am serious about this as a career, that being late for work is basic on the absolute basics, you know, and along with like being polite to people and all the other things that you should do to be a responsible part of a community. And so for me, I think like I look back on moments like that and I think, you know, for him, just another day, just another problem to deal with as a business owner. But for me, a seismic moment that really made me properly be ambitious and connect to the dots a bit more and really understand where I was in my life and what I needed to do to get to where I wanted to get to.
Have you let him know that he's had that impact on you at all? Or,
yeah. Yes, he still works with me as an advisor. So yeah. I see him fairly regularly to go through all of the challenges that we're facing. And he's a very, very kind of solid role model in my life to help me kind of be objective about everything that I'm trying to achieve, understand the role of people, the role of our creativity and the role of the financial side of our business to make that all possible. And yeah, he's just one of those people that you just connect with on a level, and you kind of have a good bandwidth. And, you know, he's no longer in our industry so directly, and now works as an advisor to a lot of companies. But for me, it was, I have told him that it was a pretty good moment.
So after graduation, you began your career at an agency called Harriman and Steele. Can you remember what it was like first stepping into the doors? Where I guess you had already stepped in the doors previously, but again, stepping in the doors again for kind of the first time.
Yeah, I think it was pretty intimidating, to be honest. I think I did an internship there in a time where the industry was having a bit of a funny time. This was kind of post the dot-com bust, which lots of people forget about, which is essentially where a lot of tech companies have been massively overvalued. They all went bust, and then a lot of agencies have been built up around that ecosystem. And so therefore, there wasn't necessarily the opportunities that maybe you would hope that there would be as a graduate. Anyway, I landed this internship, and it was tough because I really struggled to square my process that I'd had at university and the way that I worked and the way that I kind of taught myself, probably through quite a lot of quirks and quite weird ways of working, that suddenly I had to kind of wipe that all, and I had to work with these two people. And it was a small agency, and they were quite young. I think they were in their late 20s at that moment in time. And to be totally honest about this now, and maybe they'll listen to this and hear this, I don't think they gave me what I needed as an intern at all. There was some very frustrating moments for me. Like, I would quite often turn up for work and there would be no one there, and I'd have to sit on the doorstep and wait for them to come into the studio, which I feel, looking back on that now, I would never do that to an intern. And so I found stuff like that at the time, I found very frustrating. You know, there was tough things about it as well. Like, I was earning less than my rent. And so that's straight away a stress on someone who's 21 years old, because they're thinking, how on earth am I going to be able to square this away? But that wasn't their fault. They were, you know, a young company trying to make their way. And that was also very much the standard over 20 years ago as well. You were lucky to get paid for an internship at all, let alone get enough money to cover your expenses. And so I think what I found was, I found this environment where the process was completely different than I was used to. It wasn't necessarily that communicative in terms of the way that they dealt with what the tasks were and everything. You were meant to sit in the corner and get on with your work, which, you know, that works for some people, but it's not me in the way that I work as a designer. I think design at its best is a team game, and you have to really kind of pull things to bits and work through it. And so therefore, I think I needed a bit more guidance. And I found it a really, really tough experience. And it taught me loads, and I learned loads. And there was a guy there who I often think about, who was a digital designer when digital design was a very embryonic thing. And I remember being absolutely fascinated talking to him and hearing about how his process was different from traditional graphic design and the things that went with that. But my overriding memory of the whole 6 months is that my then boss played exactly the same album every morning at exactly the same time for 6 months, which to this day and age, I still think is one of the most crazy things that's ever happened to me. I can remember after a month thinking, God, he's not going to play that Strokes album again, is he? And he did. He played it at 10 a.m. every day for 6 months. So there we go. That's a weird aside, but I remember thinking that was a very, very weird thing, and I would never do that.
So you don't play the Strokes in the Koto studio now?
The Koto studio has a open Sonos policy, which anyone can put anything on, which at times is harmonious and at other times leads to very, very difficult moments, and also leads to people being incredibly mischievous. And so at one point, some joker, because it doesn't show you who's playing the music, started playing a music genre called bardcore, which I have to say I know nothing about. And so it led to many people asking, what the fuck are we listening to, again and again on repeated lessons. But, you know, there's a lesson in kind of community and being responsible to your colleagues there, but and also humour. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned when you graduated, you kind of struggled with kind of putting the pieces from your university experience into practice in sort of, you know, the real world. Do you think that, I assume you've had a lot of graduates come through the agency and things, do you think that universities on the whole prepare students for kind of design agencies?
No, not at all. And I have had some very fraught conversations with tutors in the past where I have said that I think tutors do have a responsibility to prepare their students for commercial reality, and the fact that if their students are interested in being in a commercial environment, to understand what is involved and how that works. You know, there's some great tutors out there that definitely do that. And we've been very lucky to, for example, have a good close relationship with Chelsea in London. And they've, you know, we've got a lot of ex-Chelsea people at Koto, partly because they're great people and they're enthusiastic and optimistic and all of the things that we look for, but also because I think they're taught in a way that's really conducive for us as a studio to be able to take people out of the world of education, invest in them and show them their potential, and then kind of build them into an active, brilliant team player. Whereas I think, unfortunately, some other universities are maybe stuck in the past a bit. I still see a lot of student portfolios that have very archaic thinking, and it's not the fault of the students, it's just the guidance they've been given by their tutors, who I think unfortunately are teaching a version of design that existed 30 plus years ago, dare I say. And then I think there's also a piece in that which is maybe a protest about the fact that university is paid for these days, and this idea of students as customers, and maybe that people are kind of pushing against that, and so therefore think that that it's not their spot. You know, they want to be people to be a bit more free and a bit more creative, et cetera, et cetera. But I think unfortunately what it does is it creates a delta for students to live, you know, the expectation. And I think one of the things that I've found a few times is that I know I've met a lot of graduates through the years who've gone, oh, it's fine, I'll just start my own agency. I think that's a very, very hard route. And yes, there's examples of people that have been successful doing that, but I also think it's been incredibly stressful for a lot of them as well. And so I think, you know, I am convinced that a lot of that is because of the way that design is taught in an educational environment, and it's kind of giving people no other option. Whereas actually, I think if there was a bit more consideration placed in a higher educational environment into the commercial realities, and if they connected with industry just a little bit more as well, then I think they might get a better outcome.
In the same talk that you did in 2015, you mentioned that you worked for the Masons briefly. For people that haven't listened to that talk, can you just sort of go through that?
Yeah, so I used to work, my second job was at a company that was going through a lot of change, and they were kind of half a design agency, half an editorial house, and so they would design magazines for various people. It was a pretty interesting experience for me because I hadn't really done editorial design before, so I learned quite a bit about editorial design and some of the kind of basics of that and how that worked. And it stood me in good stead later on. I did an art magazine and a few other things in my kind of freelance practice at times. So, and one of the things that came through the door there was that the Masons had decided that they had dwindling numbers and they needed to start to work on their brand. And so going from this position where they had been this kind of secretive society where no one could know anything about it to actually engage in some PR in the outside world. And so to do that, they decided that one of the things they were going to do was they were going to create their own version of GQ, but rather than it being called Gentleman's Quarterly, it was going to be called Masonic Quarterly. So a quarterly magazine, which was all about fascinating stories in the Masons. Have to say, it's one of the weirder things I've ever done. So anyway, I ended up working on the design of the debut issue of MQ, which involved meeting and understanding a lot of the world around the Masons. And then also a rather lavish launch at the Masonic HQ in London, which I have to say is one of the weirder things that I've ever done in my life. And I met a lot of very interesting people and was in a lot of very interesting rooms, but I can't say I was ever inclined to join the Masons as a result.
It sounds very backwards to have a magazine for something which is a secret society, doesn't it? It sounds almost the opposite. You're going two completely different directions with that.
Yeah, the thing that always really surprised me was how much they struggled for content. If it was really that great, you would have felt that the stories would have written themselves, but that definitely wasn't the case.
And looking at your, and this is just from your LinkedIn, but looking through sort of your career history, there's a lot of sort of agencies where you've done maybe a year and then jumped to somewhere else and then another year and jumped to somewhere else. Is there a reason for that at all, or just sort of that's how it's put, the, you know, the dice have rolled or whatever?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. I think, you know, it's the kind of thing I'd flag if I was interviewing someone now. So maybe I should look at myself first. But I spent a good lump of the middle of my career in one agency with Martin, who I mentioned earlier. But For me, I think what's happened is I've had a series of opportunities, which at times have been really good for me. And so I've opened up and delivered something else. I also think as well, from an early age, I knew that my own studio was the destination. And so therefore I was always had one eye on that. And so, you know, one of the challenges, I think, when you're in the beginning of your career is earning the opportunity to be able to lead, to be able to demonstrate to people that, you know, you can be trusted in front of clients, that you can understand the business side of creativity. You can understand the fact that, you know, there's a sales process involved, the fact that ultimately what it's about is getting a few people together to do something and then trying to sell it to a lot of people and get them to believe in it and then drive change through their organization, which there's lots of friction points in that. And so for me, as I kind of went through my 20s, I increasingly got exposed to clients. And for me, it was something I had a great interest in, but was also lucky to be quite natural at. And so I think towards the end of my 20s, what I found myself was I was going from place to place looking for increasing responsibility, but also the ability to kind of understand and learn different ways of doing things. You know, what I was trying to do was essentially build an agency based upon my experience, because I knew that having talked to other people and kind of explored the business of design, that lots of people were essentially selling something which was a combination of a little bit of this person, a little bit of this person, a little bit of this, etc. And so for me, there was a piece of that. There was also a piece of the different media that were in play. So if I look at my career up until my early 30s, I'd done a lot of graphic design and a bit of branding, but I hadn't necessarily allowed things to move so much. I hadn't necessarily done so much digital. So when I joined a company like Man vs. Machine, for example, which is obviously still one of the most excellent names when it comes to all things motion and moving, part of my want there was to very much really expose myself to that world so I could feel confident in it. And I'd done some TV branding before that, but I hadn't quite done as much as I was exposed to there. So I did 18 months there where I learned a lot of skill sets which stood me in good stead, learned about live action, learned about direction, learned about things. And I think, you know, if you are a designer in the current time that you are, I think, you know, some people can be specialists and that's great for them. But for me, I think if you have an interest in wanting to work for a lot of different people, then a lot of different abilities is really important. And that's kind of the point of it. And then when I went to Design Studio, it was very much because they had shown me the opportunity to be able to be a leader in a company that wanted to really build a serious brand offer. And so for me, I think that that was a great opportunity for me to be able to help establish that company to become the company that is today, to do some really defining projects for them when I was there, but also help upskill the talent, hire some great people, and generally try and, I guess, learn about the kind of top echelons of the business of design in a way that I knew would stand me in good stead for when it came to launching my own studio.
It's interesting, isn't it? I guess if you've started out with an end goal in mind, it would be interesting to see if you were to redo your career again without that end goal in mind, if you'd do things differently. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting thing in design, which is because we do something we love, it means that I'm not sure in some cases that people necessarily take the career side of it very seriously. And it's also, I think, because for a lot of younger designers, this trajectory where they're just looking to move up these various status stratas. So, you know, stop being a junior, become a middle, become a senior, you know, and the things that follow on that front. And I don't think people are necessarily then looking at the longer time horizon. And I think because it is quite intense as a career, and because at times I think some people can find it quite frustrating, I feel that a lot of people drop out of it as a career at some point as well. And so for me, I think I was aware of those things and I'd seen those things. And so it felt pretty vital for me to have an idea of where I was going so I could understand how I could make this thing work for me. And that sounds slightly selfish when I say that, but I just wanted to have one eye on the fact that I knew that it was a bit of a conveyor belt. And sometimes when you're involved in a conveyor belt, you can be aware that, you know, you're replaceable by someone that's kind of coming behind you that's cheaper and has more energy. And so, yeah, I was kind of hyper aware of that once I got to a certain point.
Yeah. Do you have, I don't need to know them, it's just more of a vague question, but sort of saying I've got the end goal of starting my own agency, do you have like a thing above being your own agency that you're trying to aim towards?
Yeah, death. No, I don't have something that lives beyond this. No, I think I'm not sure what would be beyond this. But for me, really, I think what it was about was, I being totally transparent to like to be in charge of things. I think anyone that's worked with me would not be surprised to hear that. And I have strong opinions on stuff and the way that things should be done. And so I am probably at that point where I'm unemployable now. So that leaves me down to having to work for myself.
Yeah, maybe that's the end goal for designers, isn't it? To become an employer, because everybody, when you hear people like who do like really big projects and really in the top level like yourself, they do say that they're unemployable, aren't they? Like you can't imagine somebody employing Peter Saville full time. Do you know what I mean? He's very much just Peter Saville, isn't he, or something?
I used to work with somebody that said the end goal for all designers was prison art. And what he meant by that was all of us kind of making slightly bad paintings somewhere,
Yeah.
hoping that what happened when we got rid of clients from our lives.
So this is sort of the midpoint in the show where I ask all my guests the same thing, and it's the idea that if we were in a metaphorical lift, don't know why we're in a lift, I don't know where we are, but and I was to ask you, if you give me one thing I could go away and search, it doesn't have to be searchable, kind of phrased it weirdly, but that sort of being the real heartbeat of your own career, and it can be a person, an experience, piece of art, piece of music, something you've done. What do you think that would be for yourself?
It's a bit of a weird answer, this, but I think it's about having fun. I think that design is far too serious. I think people take themselves far too serious. I think it's not helped by particular designers that people look up to as legends, all a bit black roll neck, very chin strokey, silent studios, suffering for it, et cetera, et cetera. I've kind of found that the best work I've done of my career has been in places where we've taking the work seriously, but we don't take everything else seriously. We don't take ourselves seriously. We have fun. We have a laugh. You're going to spend a lot of hours with the people you work with, like much more than your family, or much more than your people you live with, or friends, or anyone you play sport with, or do any of your hobbies with. And so, therefore, I think it's pretty vital that you get on with them and you kind of understand the mutual respect that needs to exist between you for you to be successful in that. And so, I think for me, it's like I look back and I think, the best times I've had in my career, I associate them with laughter and in jokes and talking about stupid stuff and sharing opinions about culture and things we like and things we don't like. And, having music on, though not the Strokes, and really, being aware of the fact that you're part of something. And so for me, I think that's the lifeblood, because also I think I'm a great believer in the theory that social bonds make us stronger and allow us to feel more empowered in ourselves. And, in a world where we are struggling with loneliness and disconnection and people not being able to connect in the same way that they were, but look at my own success, as you could deem it, I think it's being surrounded by people that I have got on with, that I've got strong bonds with, that I communicate with, and that we feel engage with each other and each other's lives. Because I think what that does is it's given me the power to deal with the tough times or overcoming things or what's going on in my personal life, et cetera, because I knew that the people around me were giving me energy that could sustain me in those moments in time.
Yeah. Do you think that, because I've spoken to people in the past who have, as you mentioned, sort of been on the other end of the argument where it's like, I need to sacrifice myself for good design almost, I've spoken to Hamish Muir from 8VO before, and he described it as like an illness. He can't turn it off in his brain, which is kind of the opposite end of it. Do you think that sort of building these sort of social, having that emphasis on kind of community and fun, because obviously, with the brands that you're working with, like Fanta as an example, that's a very social brand. Do you think it kind of lead one leads into the other, if you get what I'm saying? The same way that if you're designing a record cover, you kind of need to listen to the music to design the record cover. You need to sort of have fun to then design fun. Does that
Yeah,
make
maybe.
sense?
I think customer aware. I think there's kind of two answers there. Customer awareness or customer position awareness is vitally important. So we have to understand who we're designing for. So, if we're designing a B2B SaaS company's website, some emojis for Coca-Cola or a video game package for someone else. But I don't think that necessarily has to reflect to the mind state that you were in when you designed that thing. I think, you know, we could design something that's incredibly serious and stuff. Like, you know, we could be working on an investment platform for someone, which is all about kind of trust and rigor and people looking after their money. But we could be listening to loud music and having a fun time when we're doing it. Or, you know, and I don't want to paint Koto as like wall-to-wall lols every day, because it's not, because it's, you know, it's hard work like anything else is. But I think the fun and the laughter and enjoying it is probably what makes it bearable in amongst the... But I wouldn't go as far as say Mission describe it as an illness, but maybe I don't take it as seriously as he does.
So, yeah, jumping forward... You obviously started your own agency in 2014 called Koto. If someone was to ask you one piece of advice if they were going to start their own agency, knowing now what you didn't know then, what would that be?
Don't let the momentum drop. I think it's really important when you start something to come out the gates and go strong at it. But I didn't take any investment to start Koto. I just saved a little bit of money myself. And we just had to hustle our way through it. And I think some people think that hustle culture is a negative thing, and you know, the internet encourages behaviors and work-life balance, et cetera, et cetera. I think ultimately the reality is, if you want to build something from nothing that doesn't exist, you can't be watching 5 hours of Netflix a day. It's just not a thing. You have to be able to sacrifice, put everything into it. And when opportunities come, you need to understand and recognize that opportunity, convert that opportunity, and then off the back of that, build that into another opportunity and keep on doing that, because you have to keep on going. And I think, you know, so many agencies don't get where they need to get to because people run out of energy. And I completely understand that. It's not for everybody. I think being an agency owner is, it does take a particular mind state, and it does take in a particular tenaciousness. But for me, I think, you know, I've worked with agencies in the past to help mentor them, and you know, lots of people reach out to me asking for advice, because that's just a side effect of where I find myself. And I think that momentum thing is what I always come back to. You just have to get that momentum, and you have to keep going at it, and understand that, you know, there's many different ways of looking at it, but opportunity is not going to walk through the door. That said, I am a great believer in, if you get your head down, get on with it, do work, do great work, and put it out in the world, as long as you can have the ability to hold the line, success will find you in the long run.
So jumping back to the talk you did in 2015 again, and obviously now I realise it's quite a long time ago, so if it is just your thinking has changed, then that's fine. But you mentioned that design success is 30% design, 30% organisation, 30% hustle, and 10% mystery. And in that talk, I think you were a bit pressed for time, so you had to kind of spit it out and then just move on to the next thing. But I was curious, could you sort of expand on that a little bit, and where did those things come from?
Yeah, I think I probably still think that. So for me, I think there is an illusion, which is probably spread by our time in education, that design can be like 95% design and then 5% emails and whatever else that exists around it. I just don't think that's the case at all. I think that's incredibly unrealistic for people. I think for me, there's the whole piece of work you have to do, which is around, who am I working for? So if I've got a client, you have to spend time on understanding that client, understand who they are, what their motivations are, why they're commissioning this piece of work, understand the dynamics that exists within that company. You know, if I think about all of the projects that have gone terribly wrong in my career, which luckily there aren't too many, but those that have gone terribly wrong, I think in almost every case, there was a complexity that existed on their side that maybe I didn't quite give enough credence to, or I didn't understand. Now, there's an element of that, which is some people are just fucking arseholes and there's nothing you can do about that. But there's some projects that have gone wrong where I definitely think actually you were capable for that, and you maybe should have paid more attention to that signal, or you should have thought about the way that that was said in that meeting or whatever, and maybe your ego got in the way, or et cetera. I think off the back of that, that what that means is that as a designer, you also need to think that, how am I spending my time? And I think sat in Figma, cranking out work, as vital as that is probably ignoring the organizational part. It's just that piece where things happen and there's nothing you can do about it. You've got your controllables on your uncontrollables, and that mystery sits in a way. Mystery can also be incredibly additive. You know, the number of times I've been stuck on something or a bit kind of unsure about something, and I've ended up walking past something and seen like a moment, whether that's like a ripped poster or I walk past an art gallery and something's in the window, or I've overheard a snippet of conversation in the train or something, or I've listened to a podcast and someone says something. And I've often thought, like, that's it. That's what I needed. And then I kind of take it on and move on, which is why I think I've found COVID so hard, because you're not much less exposed to those things trapped in your spare room, in the loft, day in, day out on Zoom. You're just not allowing yourself to kind of free your mind and kind of find those other moments and those other things that are happening. But yeah, I think the thing I was trying to say in 2015, which probably does still ring true to me now, is being a designer is not all about doing design. You have to think about the teamwork element. You have to think about the communication. You have to think about the organization. You know, I think you have to think about setting yourself up for success so that the work you're making isn't just going to be put on a wall and recognized as genius. It's actually going to be something that needs to be considered from all parts.
Given the role that you have now, what would you say your role, because are you a designer?
No, I don't think I am anymore. I'd say I'm part creative director, definitely a leader, part mentor. And then I would say that a lot of the rest of the time is about kind of relationships and talking to people, communicating, and also how we project ourselves in the world.
Yeah. You've mentioned in sort of other talks how you sort of take sport ideas from sports and kind of put them into what you're doing. Is that more of a thing now than it was beforehand when you were a designer, do you think?
Yeah, probably. I think, you know, there's a responsibility level that I have as the boss of a big company, which is there's, you know, people that every day go to work around the world who've got mortgages, in some cases children, but they've got, you know, hopes and dreams, etc. And so therefore I have to live up to their responsibility and kind of keep things moving forward for them in a effective way, so we make sure that Koto isn't a static thing. It's something that changes and adapts to markets and market conditions. I think sport is very good for that, because, you know, sports evolution, team sports, you know, you look at any team sport today, it's not played the same as it was 10 years, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. You can even say that about individual sports, you know, and whether that's nutrition or motivation or any of the other aspects, those things are evolving and changing. And I think business is no different. I think the reason I pull to the sport and the metaphor that exists within that is because these are organizations where they've really codified it and they've really sat down and worked out what leads to success. Because there's, in many cases, so much money involved and so much pressure involved that there's almost a need to be able to do that. Whereas I think maybe in the world of design and organization, I think we've for many years allowed individual brilliance or creative flair to be enough. And everything else around it has maybe been a bit chaotic and badly organized, dare I say. And kind of that was justified because the end justified the means. I don't believe that to be true. And so I think by looking outside of our industry to other industries, whether that's sport, whether that's the world of business, whether that's, you know, science, technology, whatever it is, I think for me, you can learn so much from there, which you can then apply, because you're going to create a happier, more productive workforce, people that are more engaged with each other. And that's not to say that we get it right 100% of the time, because no one does, because as we all know, failure leads to growth and growth leads to like change. And, you know, the company we are today from 9 years on is pretty different. And I'm sure if we sat here in 9 years again and started talking again, we would be in a very different place again. And so that's why I think it, to go back to your original question, I think that's why it resonates for me so much, because it is about people, it is about excellence, and it's about something existing within something that acknowledges that the landscape is changing constantly and you have to evolve within it.
You also mentioned in that talk, I know I'll keep jumping back to that talk, but there's not a lot of you online. you are scared of failure, and your goal, as you mentioned with Koto, is to kind of be the elite, the best, kind of the front runner of the industry. Is it difficult managing these two things? And I was thinking then also, the way you talk about it, it's almost like if you were to put a project out and it bombed and it kind of fucked up, it's almost like you've just it's over, it's game over almost. Is that the mentality sort of, or?
Fear as a motivating factor can be powerful, but shouldn't be your only motivating factor as far as I'm concerned. Because if you're operating in fear, then you're operating in negativity. And I don't think negativity is a positive place to be all the time. Now, fear now and again is like an adrenaline boost, something to kind of like shock you. You know, we all get nervous and we all have those moments where we go like, oh my God, do I know what I'm doing here? And I think that can be powerful and can be, you know, a good boost. And, you know, a little bit of nerves or a little bit of fear means that you're taking something seriously and you're aware of the consequences of it. But I don't see it as like a overriding factor in terms of how I feel when I get up in the morning, everything. And in terms of being part of the elite, I think for me, I've always felt that I'm spending my time and energy on this and I'm making sacrifices. And so if I don't aspire to be the best at it, then I'm not sure what the point is, because I really am focused on trying to do the best that we can do. And the way to do that is, in one level, to measure you against others, but more importantly, to measure you against yourself. And I think a bit of a divergent thought, but relevant for me, is one of the things I always get most frustrated about in this career is if we've lost an opportunity to another agency, and then they put it out and it's average work, below average work, just kind of a bit, you know, dialing it in. There's nothing more that gets my goat, because I just think not only have we lost that, but we've lost it to someone who's then not bothered. And I don't know why, but that really, really frustrates me, because I think, you know, like everybody, I'm wrong, and we don't hit everything every time, and we can't win every project and we can't do everything well. And I've got nothing but massive respect to agencies that we lose to and then do a brilliant job of it. And I will always try to go out my way to tell those agencies that I think they've done a brilliant piece of work with that. But for me, the elite mentality, or as we describe it at COTO, the pursuit of excellence, is about understanding that if you're going to try and achieve something, then you do it seriously.
Kind of pushing to be the best. Do you ever struggle with creative block or imposter syndrome? And if you do, I guess it doesn't, if you're not designing, I guess you might not come face to face with that. But if you do, or in the past, did you have any ways of kind of dealing with these things?
I used to get creative block reasonably badly in my mid to late 20s. And I think if I was to look back on that now, I think it was because I put too much pressure on myself. I think I was setting out the beginning of every project, wanting everything to be the best it could possibly be. Now, that's positive in a way, because you're being ambitious. But the downside of it is I think I was sabotaging myself before I'd even moved a mouse or written anything down, because I was trying to over-obsess about the expectation of others. And actually what I should have done, and if I was to give myself some advice back to it now, is understand that the complete designer doesn't exist. You're not going to be the best that you can be by trying to do everything and be everything. Actually, I think design at its best is a team game, because it requires the intersection of each other's ideas and the rub of those to rub against each other, where you find really interesting moments and you find that moment of distinctiveness or differentiation, etc. In terms of imposter syndrome, it's not something I have ever struggled with, but I appreciate that I'm in the minority there and a lot of other people struggle with it. I think the only time I ever feel anything close to it is when I come into a client contact with someone who's genuinely brilliant. And there's a handful of people that I have met in my career who I've been lucky to meet who, in the conversation I've had with them, I've felt their intellectual power, their ability to be able to master a myriad of different topics or subjects, speak about them at, you know, complete expertise and level. I've met some people in my career who have the ability to make amazing creative or logical leaps and jump from place to place and completely take everybody with them. And so the only time I ever feel close to imposter syndrome is when you're in a conversation with someone like that and you're really having to try and be your best self at your most maximum, and not struggling to keep up, but you can feel the effort to keep up, to be with them. And I think that's the only time I've ever felt anything to be like imposter syndrome. But I think the thing that's been good about that as well is that you're exposed to these people that have this amazing capability, and it can't help but rub off on you in some way.
So yeah, COTO have done a litany of amazing projects in its life cycle. One of the more recent ones you've done is you've rebranded Call of Duty, which I play Call of Duty. One thing I did want to mention, and I've told the people that I would mention, when you play, I don't know if you've actually played it, the kerning is really fucked in the actual game. So I know you've sat and designed these really nice fonts. The kerning is horrible. It's completely broken. And I know it's probably not even Activision's fault, because there's so much text
that it's probably just done through a computer system or whatever. But yeah, it looks horrible because the kerning is like, this is a bit here. It looks like separate words. But I wanted to know, if that's gone off on a tangent, but I wanted to know, how did that come about? And what was the process kind of from the brief to kind of the end design with that?
So it came about through somebody that we had worked with previously was working at Activision. And so they recommended us. And I think we're really lucky to have a personal recommendation in that moment in time. And to be totally honest, that's how a lot of our work comes to us, which is someone that's either previously worked with us or knows someone that's previously worked with us, recommends us for someone else. And that's that kind of network effect thing that once we get to a certain scale, we're lucky to be able to benefit from. In terms of that process, that's a pretty big process because obviously that's a very valuable piece of computer game history that's played by a lot of people around the world every year. And so my business partner, Joey, led that engagement with Activision and saw them through the brand transformation as we went through a very typical process of discovery to really understand who they were and what they wanted to achieve. And then went through a journey of evolution and revolution to convert their brand into what we've put out in the world today. I think, you know, however successful something is, people know that they need to evolve it and keep it moving. And so I think, you know, we're very lucky to work on such a landmark piece of work. But the process was very typical to how we work with almost everybody we work with, which is understand the evolution that needs to happen and then manage that and try and bring creative brilliance to kind of make that work.
Yeah. Do you have kind of, and if you've got sort of magic sauce that you can't talk about, you know, feel free to tell me, shut up. But do you have kind of an approach to, if every project kind of has the same life cycle, do you have sort of steps that you hit to kind of get to where you want to be with it?
Yeah, it's a bit more of a mind state thing we find. So we've got kind of three mind states. So the first one is collaboration. And I think it's a word that's easy to use, but from our point of view, we like to think about it through the level of co-creation, which is the people that we're working with are not just audience members there to kind of witness our brilliance. They are active participants within a creative job. And so therefore what we do with them, we kind of take their knowledge about the brand. You know, a lot of the people we work with have worked at these companies for many years and have got a depth of knowledge that we can only ever dream of. So it's a case of understanding that, taking that and extracting that and using it effectively. There's an optimism aspect to it. You know, change is hard. There's always a million reasons not to change something. And so we have to be optimistic about the outcome and keep pushing forward. Otherwise, what happens is you can give up. And in the moment that you give up, you begin to lose momentum. And once you've lost that momentum, then the change isn't going to make its way through. And then the third thing is craft. I think it's very easy to kind of get fixated with a big idea and where a big idea is taking you and what it's going to deliver to. But unless you sweat those small details and really make sure that you're really applying that to everything, including the kerning, you're not going to be able to see the full success of what something can become. I think it's very easy when people have been through a very big, hard process, which is what a lot of rebrands can be like, that they then ran out of energy and don't finish that last piece. And that's something that we'd really try to avoid.
And you also recently helped Google to rebrand Bard to Gemini, which is Google's sort of foray into the AI space. Bridging off of sort of the back of that, do you have any thoughts on sort of AI within the creative sector as a whole?
Yeah, I think it's something that everyone's going to be grappling with quite heavily in the coming months and years. I think the way that I see it is I think it's an augmentation to creativity. I think if you go back to the advent of desktop computers in the end of the 80s, the beginning of the 90s, a lot of people felt that design was going to die in that moment in time and computers were just going to do it all. What actually we saw was the speeding up of a creative process, and what had been a laborious handmade process of people having to lay things out was suddenly democratized, put in the hands of the many, and people could express their creativity through this desktop piece and, you know, graphic user interface and all of the evolutions that we now know the story of. Similarly, I think, you know, on a much, much smaller scale, if you think about something of the advent of the iPad and the ability for people to be able to create amazing illustrations utilizing pencil and an iPad, you know, in a way that it would almost be not impossible, but near on impossible for them to fully hand render that level of kind of possibility. That's yet again another moment of acceleration. I think what we're seeing right now is just a very extreme version of that acceleration. And so obviously that's unsettling a lot of people. Now, that to say is I do think it will lead to some redundancies. And what I don't mean there is physical redundancies of people. I think more redundancies of certain skill sets within the overall creative. And so I think it's about understanding that, empowering that. My concern with it is that we'll end up with a kind of homogenous AI stew, which is something that's kind of like very middle ground. And if we think of a lot of people's personal favorite pieces of design or creativity, quite often there's a kind of maverick individual quality to it. And what we don't want to do is have a world where essentially everything is just a recooked version of something that existed in the past. Because I feel as culture, we're always getting quite guilty of that. Anything, you know, the fact that 90s clothing is back around again is kind of showing that we have that potential to look backwards rather than forwards. And I think AI could accelerate that. That said, I think it's absolutely vital for designers and creatives to embrace it where they think it's relevant and use it to empower their work. Just understanding the consequences, understanding where you use it and where you don't use it. And I think that'll grow with that. I think the piece that hasn't been cleared up yet and I can't quite see the answer on is copyright. And so that's the bit that I'll be watching with very big fascination.
Yeah, that idea of it looking backwards, because I guess it can't really make anything new, can it? Because it is just going from whatever we fed it. That's a very interesting thing. Do you have a way of kind of, because originality is kind of a big topic, isn't it? In the fact that nothing's really original. Do you have a way of kind of trying to come up with something which is one of one in the studio or even in your creative practice?
Try not to over-fixate on originality, because I think it can be a course of madness for people. I think it's more a case of understanding the old adage, it doesn't matter where you've taken it from, it's where you're taking it to. And I think, you know, every piece of creativity is a response to a previous piece of creativity. We haven't grown up in a vacuum. We've grown up based around influences. And so, of course, reference happens. And I think when I hear designers say that they're never influenced by others, I think it's the biggest load of bullshit I've ever heard in my life. But you just can't help but be influenced, whether you're conscious or subconscious about it. But that doesn't mean that we're not kind of like negligent to originality. All it means is we don't overemphasize it. We like to think about things within the greater context and understand where we've come from.
Jumping, I didn't know where to put this in the podcast, so I kind of lumped it in at the end. But jumping back to students, I assume you've had a lot of students come through the studio. When you're looking at a student portfolio, is there any sort of qualities that you look for in the work or even the person?
Yeah, I think there's a few different things which when I look back on it and think about the people is, I think openness is really important. So we want people that are kind of like open to change and understand where they are on that journey. I think energy and enthusiasm is pretty important. I think, you know, there's that kind of too cool for school designer thing, which I'm not particularly interested in. You know, I think, you know, we want to engage with the fact that anybody that we've got that's coming in here, they have to kind of work with other people and understand their kind of human interaction and the way that works and things that go on that front. I think curiosity around the world around them is also really, really good. I think some people have maybe decided what they like and then kind of ignore the rest of the world. Whereas actually, I think if you're a designer, particularly in graphic or brand design, you don't really have the luxury to do that. You have to understand that you're at any point you could be deployed on something that's you think's commercially cheesy or something that doesn't sit within like this kind of taste barometer that you've maybe grown through your kind of teenage years and your early 20s. So I think like a full awareness of what's around you and the way the world works is a pretty vital component.
And sort of beginning to round it off, I ask everyone the same thing at the end, and it's kind of cheesy and kind of corny, but if you could go back in time and give yourself one piece of advice, knowing what you know now when you first got started, what do you think that would be?
I think it would be a line, something I said earlier, which is the complete designer doesn't exist. Don't beat yourself up for your weaknesses. Everyone has weaknesses. We can't be great at everything in life. And so therefore, you know, there's that school of thought that says you have to like strengthen all your weaknesses. You do have to do all these things. You know, there's been moments in time where there's been bits of software which I struggled to learn, but I felt like I had to learn because there was some need for me to be able to do that. And I think what I found was I've got like this technological limitation. So at times in the past, I've tried to teach myself to code on a number of times, and I'm just not that way minded. I just can't get past some quite, I'm sure, basic level coding. And that's actually okay. That's fine. there's this idea that everyone, you know, there was this moment where all designers had to code, and I kind of listened to that a bit too much at that time. And I think as I look at in my middle age of my life, I think, you know, it's not a case of just not trying, because I do think it's important to try, but I think it's a case of don't beat yourself up about the things that you're not necessarily strong at.
Yeah, I guess, again, it comes back to that idea of just being able to lean on other people, whereas sometimes you might think, nah, I'm the best in the world, I'll do all of this myself, but it's kind of, there are better motion graphic designers, and there are better logo designers or whatever. And then super, super, super lastly, well, I've said it three times, I don't know, where can people find yourself online?
You can find me on X, formerly known as Twitter, as @Gradiat, which is G-R-A-D-I-A-T, or you can find me on Instagram under the same handle. And if LinkedIn's your thing, you can find me just under James Greenfield.
What do you think, just as a random one at the end, what do you think of the X to, or the Twitter to X rebrand?
Always hire a professional, and he definitely didn't hire a professional.
No, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. Thank you very much.
Hello again. Hope you enjoyed that. I'd like to thank James for coming on, because I assume he's a very, very, very busy man. And he took sort of an hour out of his day just to let me fire a load of questions at him. He's got an amazing mind for sort of everything, design and branding. And the way he speaks, sort of, he doesn't have to think about his answers. It's very strange. He just sort of fires them out as if he's got them pre-prepared. Even if it's something that's sort of a brand new question, he just seems to just get it straight away. But yeah, I hope you enjoyed, as I said. Sorry there's been a bit of a gap between this one and the last episode. I feel like I say that every episode now, but that's just how it is, really. I've got some lined up coming up, so there should be a few sort of in the pipeline that's going to come out, so look forward to that, I guess. I shall speak at you next time.